their idea for them is messaging, is communication strategy. Like, I mean, some of the branches have even changed public affairs officer titles to Comstrat, communication and strategy. And that to me is a sign that you're not open to the public. You are strategizing your communication for the best effect for you, but not for the people who are actually like paying the bill and sending people to serve in your ranks.
Hello, team. Welcome back. Mops and Moes, Alex and Drew. This week, we're stepping a little bit outside the normal conversations around health and fitness. Alex, who do we have on?
Yeah, it's a little bit about fitness, but it's primarily about journalism and the military and how they relate and all that stuff. So we brought on an expert from that world. Todd South is editor at large for Military Times, which publishes Air Force Times, Army Times, Marine Corps Times, and Navy Times.
Maybe one day Space Force Times.
Maybe.
Or just horoscopes.
Damn it. Todd has written about crime, courts, government, and the military for multiple publications since 2004. You'll learn a little bit about his career path when we chat with him today. And he was named a 2014 Pulitzer finalist for a co-written project on witness intimidation. You'll also hear this, but Todd served as a Marine in the Iraq War, and some of his favorite topics include marksmanship and fitness. So that's how he and I ended up chatting, was around the fitness issue.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we wanted to have Todd on, one, and he'll mention this, he's listened to every single one of the episodes, so we appreciate that first and foremost, but also just I think the nature of some of the conversations that we've had, both on the podcast and on Instagram, sort of butt up against or are adjacent to the media and some of the dynamics, you know, that world kind of entails. And so what better person to bring on than an expert in the field? And that is definitely what Todd is.
And if you've been entertained by my weird forays into investigative journalism before and my chats about FOIA stuff, stay tuned until the end of the episode. You'll get some pro tips from a guy who knows way more than I will ever know about how to do that stuff.
And I'll also, maybe I'll leave a little teaser here, but I don't think this is the last we'll hear of Todd in the Mops and Moes galaxy as we continue to circle some controversial topics as it pertains to human performance in the military. I think this is a voice that you'll hear more often. So enjoy.
He means on post fast food is what he means. That's
maybe. We won't name names, but you know, maybe it's one of those hills that we've said that we're going to die on. So stay tuned and enjoy.
So I was in Marine enlisted active duty from 98 to 2003. I got out and went back to on the GI Bill about a year later and got into journalism, started a paid byline pretty much immediately. So I've been in, next year will be 20 years I've been in journalism. And mostly local newspapers, regional, state level, and all the way up to the federal coverage of a variety of topics until I got to Military Times a little over 6 years ago. And so that's kind of the space I've been working in. So I've seen a lot from that point of view. But also, I'm super biased as any human being is. I feel like I have a unique point of view because I served both pre and post 9/11 in a 5-year contract, did it a combat deployment, then got out and literally like walked as far away from the military as I could for 10 years on purpose just to do other reporting. And then came here and I don't know how well the audience will remember folk tales, but I feel like Rip Van Winkle, like you go out and take a nap and you kind of wake up 20 years later, you come back and everything's changed and some things haven't. And so coming back into this space as a reporter 6 years ago, 15 odd years after I'd left the military, was an interesting experience. And definitely kind of seeing things from different perspectives. So.
I hope people know what Rip Van Winkle is, please.
Hey man, I'm in my 40s and my daughter's 12 and she's never heard of him until I told her. So, yeah.
So you kind of alluded to it there, but since you've been on both sides of it, you've been the guy in the uniform and you've been the guy behind the microphone, so to speak. I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about that relationship, like the military media relationship, because it's come up indirectly on here before. Nick Barringer's episode where he talked about the OPAT and stuff touched on a lot of like media relations issues and like First Amendment for service member kind of issues and stuff like that. So I'd love to hear it from somebody who's on the other side of that problem set right now.
Oh, yeah, sure. So most of what... I'll try to keep it chronological so I don't go all over the place. And please pull me in at any time. I can over talk for sure. When I was in the Marines, I wasn't thinking about going into journalism. That was not my field. First, I did radios, and I got into a reconnaissance unit, did recon stuff, which was really, really fun. Like I kind of, the Marine thing I always wanted to do. And then, but I always liked to read and write. So when I was getting out, I was like, well, what am I going to do? Well, I'm not going to work at Barnes & Noble serving coffee while I write the Great American Novel. So I'll look at journalism. And that's kind of the unplanned, kind of scheduled path. However, briefly, I was in I was at OIF-1 during the embedded invasion in 03 with 2nd Recon Alpha Company. And we briefly, for like a week or so, had a reporter and a photographer embedded with us from a local paper in Georgia. So I was like, oh, well, I could do that. I've already got like combat experience. I could go back and report and do those kind of things. So that was my only touch with the media whatsoever, uniform. And then came out of undergrad with the University of Georgia, did that whole thing, started local newspapers there and then all throughout the South, and only kind of touched on military stuff with, you know, guard deployments. Unfortunately, a lot of military funerals during the height of the wars, you know, folks coming home, redeployments, transitions, veteran issues from that perspective, from a very local perspective. And then worked my kind of way up the different local newspaper ranks until I last landed in New Jersey, where my wife is from. And then the job opportunity came up down here. I kind of gave another consideration of, you know, military defense reporting after kind of avoiding it for a long time, just because didn't want to be typecast and stereotyped. And got down here, and I've been enjoying it quite a bit. So that's the kind of bios, you know, my background. So it was interesting because I spent like 16 years or so in local reporting in multiple states doing a variety of topics. And then coming to the DC, and there's like that term, the DC bubble, there really is kind of a bit, at least in media, there's definitely a bubble. You know, you get here and no offense to my colleagues, some of them are supremely talented and they're probably my boss one day, or already are, and they're super smart and they go to great schools. But when they do the undergrad, grad school, DC pipeline in journalism, they don't really see a lot of like the rest of the country and like how people actually live. And on the military side, it's even a further disconnect because the vast majority of them, even in the defense reporting and national security reporting space, vast majority are not veterans, did not serve, had very little interaction with the military until they were covering it. And like with any beat, so I'll just give you a quick rundown. You know, over the course of my 15, 16 odd years in local reporting, I covered police, I covered zoning, I covered local politics, I covered business, I covered courts, bankruptcy, criminal, federal, civil. I did feature writing, I covered more local government, state government. I was never a cop. I was never a lawyer. I never ran for office, but I had to learn it on the job, right? So there's the value to that I would argue for is that you're coming in with a fairly neutral point of view. You just have the skills of a journalist. You're trying to apply them to a beat that you're kind of learning to become a semi-expert in, but you always defer to the real experts. But you're always learning a new subculture. So that's the kind of positive side. Like, I think you're coming in with a fresh perspective. And I always try to play tug of war and battle my own kind of personal biases, having served in the Marine Corps, and what that does when I look at the Army or look at the Navy and the perspective I'm coming at it from. I hope journalism helps, at least the skills I've learned. And then back to the whole bubble thing. I know I'm jumping around again. Sorry. In the kind of DC atmosphere, like, journalism period is just, it's just done differently. It's very much what you would call access journalism. And again, I need to catch a breath at some point. So if you want to stop me, you can.
Keep going.
But okay, cool. So access journalism essentially is what it sounds like, getting access to people you need to talk to. And 9 times out of 10, that's an intermediary. In my space in military, it's a public affairs officer. Mm-hmm. And they have a whole different idea of what they want out of an interaction with their superior, or the person they're kind of handling, versus what you want. And I think the kind of classic viewpoint from a lot of people who haven't interacted with journalists very often, especially in the military, and I say this as a prior, you know, enlisted Marine, active duty, is what they see in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, journalists are just out to get you, and it's all tabloid style and shoving microphones in your face and like springing like curveball questions on you. And it's pretty rare, really.
So the origin story of Mops and Moes is that I wanted to get some of this like useful, actionable fitness and health information out to soldiers. And there were just so many hurdles to jump through to just like communicate effectively from like a proponent type of element or a schoolhouse type of element in the Army, just out to the Army itself. And that's just PAO hurdles to communicate from one Army organization out to the rest of the Army. I cannot imagine the public affairs hurdles of trying to do like actual external journalism coverage on the Army. Can you talk through a little bit just like the battles of communicating through PAOs?
So, oh my God. I mean, it's like, I would say, I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say like a third of my week is spent like juggling emails, trying to get the right contact, sourcing things through one office to get punted or hot potato tossed off to another office, And I've been doing this 6 years, and I was in the Marine Corps, and I understand the military, and I know the structure. Like, I can say what a battalion is. I can say what a brigade is. You know, I know what a rank is. Like, I know the regulations for the most part. Like, imagine, you know, like, we have people come here, like, right out of grad school or even undergrad. They get hired. They've never even seen a military base or someone in uniform outside of on television. And they're like trying to like decipher all that. So yeah, that's just like the clearing the throat aspect. But I'll give you an example. So here's a good one. So perfect example for Mops and Mo's. I reached out after I attended the H2F symposium in late April at Fort Eustis, which I attended last year as well. And it's just some basic quick hit coverage of what happened during that. And you're kind of covering the event and you have to justify the trip and the expense to go down there. So you have to like put out bylines like that day. I mean, you can't. I'm typing up the last panel as the next panel.
Before you go farther on this one,
the guy with two monitors in the front row.
I had to explain it to a number of people why there was somebody up front, like actively sending emails and stuff. I was like, for a reason, it's his job. That's why he's there. It's okay.
Who's that asshole in the front not paying attention? No, he's paying attention.
I'm paying more attention than most of them, I promise you, because I'm quoting everything they're saying. No, I'm not kidding. I'm quoting a lot of what they're saying. So yeah, so there's that aspect. It's like you're at an event. That's one way. I mean, we're talking like majority. I guess I'm kind of speaking for the majority of the quote unquote defense national security press, which is kind of niche and very much focused on like that service or that aspect or that issue or whatever. And we kind of know the language and we're kind of known commodities or quantities, I guess, you know, in those areas. And I'm having to kind of like generate bylines as I'm going, like as the event's happening. And then simultaneously, I'm kind of like queuing up a list of like, okay, here's stuff I want to follow up on. Like, great example. You guys just had him on your podcast, Colonel Klepper at the 173rd. So I'm listening to his presentations and I'm like, boom, boom, boom. Like light bills, like alarm bills are going off. Like, I'm like, okay, that's a story. Like he's seeing like, and it's not scientific, you know, peer reviewed, but he's seeing like reductions in soldier incidents. He's seeing reductions in alcohol abuse and issues. He's seeing increased like physical fitness aspects, all from doing these types of things. I've not heard anybody talk about that. And I've been covering this for a couple of years. So that's a story. Boom. But I don't want to just, I really didn't want, like I could have just written what he said in that presentation. I actually did include a little bit of it in another piece I pulled out of that event, you know, kind of same day or the next day. But I was like, this needs more. Like this is a fuller interview. I got to know more from this guy. Well, so think about it. Like he's never met me. His PAO doesn't know me. Mm-hmm. They know Army Times, and I'd be happy. We can please put a pin in this, and we'll come back to it. Army Times has a certain reputation with some people, has a certain reputation with other people. It has Marine Corps Times is. For I was in 25 years ago, Marine Corps Times, who I now write for 6 years and have edited, is commonly referred to as Marine Corps Crimes because we highlight it when people get in trouble. We also highlight the good stuff. I mean, people notice the bad stuff, but we highlight all of it, you know? So that's those factors. Like the PAO doesn't know me. The colonel doesn't know me. I'm lucky if, you know, maybe the CIMT, you know, commander or PAO like vouches for me and says, yeah, you should talk to this guy because they don't have to talk to me. I mean, I want them to. And I think personally, just as a citizen, as a taxpayer in a democracy, like you should talk to the press about what you do if your paycheck is coming from the taxes. I mean, I don't know, just my thoughts.
Makes
but
sense.
Who knows, yeah. So I thought, now, admittedly, I got a little busy the next week or two. I was traveling for a couple of other events and I wound up reaching out. Actually, that's not true. I actually had reached out initially to a PAO at TRADOC to connect me with them. And of course, schedules are crazy. That person is great. And I've worked with that person before many times. And they were helpful, but it still took a few, it took about a week or so before I got the, oh yeah, here's who you should contact. And then I sent over some email with some queries. I said, hey, this is Army Times. Here's some links to stuff I've done recently. I covered some stuff at the H2F conference. Here's the people I could kind of like my bona fides, like here's kind of why you should trust me. I was trying to get an interview by like early June. And I was starting in mid-May or late May, and I'm supposed to talk to him on Thursday. So in any other circles of news, they wouldn't even let me continue. Like that would have been like, sorry, they didn't respond, move on to the next story. I happen to be, after doing this 20 years, fairly productive, so I can keep the balls kind of in the plate spinning and the balls juggling over here while I can kind of work that on the side and try to find a different angle that pushes it beyond what he said in April. Because whatever he said in April is old news. Like, no, nobody cares by May 1 when he said on April 28th. That's just the nature of news, sadly. So, yeah, that's a clear example. Like 4 or 5 weeks later, I now have a phone call with a colonel about, and just to be frank, and this is a positive story. I mean, positive in the fact that it has some positive news, going to generate some interest, I hope. And like, so far, so good. What I've seen from it seems beneficial. Now imagine if I'm reaching out to him and he doesn't want to talk to me, and it's something that's bad that's gone out of his command. You know, like, well, 9 times 10, he's not going to talk to me at all, but I'm still going to try. So I'm going to spool off again another bad direction. So go ahead.
Now, so this is not a question or anything. I just want to take a moment because this may be construed as bashing on PAOs, and I feel like my PAO probably listens to this.
Bless their hearts.
Not trying to get in too much trouble, you know, but I do greatly appreciate them. I understand that their job is different and they like have competing demands they have to answer to and stuff. And just a brief shout out, because the timing is perfect. Today is June 20th.
Is this National PAO Day?
No, one of the guys in our PAO, I'm not going to name, they don't need the heat from being named on Mops Mills or anything, but one of the guys in our PAO office, was a civilian. He starts basic training today. So,
hey,
it's pretty cool.
I do have a question, and I also don't want to bash PAOs, but I have noticed this even for Alex and I reaching out and trying to talk to people and, you know, brushing up against what you could probably call controversial topics, which I imagine you do quite a bit more than we do. How do you get the truth from folks? Because, like, for example, I don't know why, but with academia, I've encountered more PAOs with academia than any other field we've sort of dove into. And they always, you know, we need a list of all the questions you're going to ask. We have to have everything prepped. And it's like, okay, great. But what we have found is that sort of the free flowing organic conversation is where a lot of the truth comes out. So I'm curious how you've been able to extrapolate some of that as you deal with these hierarchies and these PAOs and all the different, I guess, hurdles you have to jump through.
I mean, I'll be frank. I mean, the higher the rank, the less likely I'm going to get it at all. It almost always is going to be very scripted. And I do want to continue. But I do have to say before I forget, I'm also not bashing PAOs. I mean that sincerely. I'm not just kind of covering my butt here. Like, there are bad ones out there. There are people that are just bad at their job, like literally just bad at their job. They just do not respond to things. That's like your whole job.
I love how we inadvertently made a PA. We love you, PAOs. We love you guys.
But I will say, like, it's a job I would never want to have. I mean, they're always on the receiving end of I mean, they're called flacks for a reason, because they catch flack, right? Like that, like they're constantly dealing with, I mean, they may deal with me and they may know me after maybe I've gotten to know them. They've been on station for a couple, 3 years. We've done multiple interactions. They've seen my work. They see that I'm an honest guy. And even if I have a tough question, I'm going to be fair. And at the same time, they're getting 5 different, you know, requests from like the local media near the base that has some controversial thing they want to talk about. And CNN has this thing because they want to talk about some big, huge issue. And this is the base that's going to, or this particular command is going to be the one to be the example of that. And also they're fielding queries from people who know nothing about the military, and they're having to like decipher and translate what they're trying to ask about because they're asking the wrong person. Like, I don't know how many times we're on a call, like an invited, you know, media call about a specific topic. And there's always some reporters randomly asked like something that has nothing, like just random, like some battalion commander's talking about like a new weapon, you know, new sidearm's been issued to their unit. They're the first one to get it in the army, for instance. I used to cover like modular handgun stuff a lot a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And some random reporter will be like, you know, sir, what do you think about the rise in sexual assaults in the military? It's like that's nothing to do with what we're talking about. I'm sorry, I'm trailing, but like, I'm just saying that to say that POs have a heck of a job. I really do respect it. It's just frustrating because I came from a place in local reporting where I literally had like the cell phone number of the sheriff and the DA and the mayor. And I could on a Saturday drop by the police station and talk to somebody. And because they knew who I was and I was a local reporter. And like, so I'm just coming from that kind of dream scenario to this, where it's like 5 levels between you and the next person you need to talk to. So, but back to the truth, I would say, ultimately, what you do, and I learned this a lot on covering the courts beat for many years, which was a really, really a great like learning experience. In that, courts was great because there were always documents that gave you some information. Like anytime something happens in court, something's been filed. So whether anybody wants to talk to you or not, you're still going to write. And that was the nice pressure I always had, like the leverage I had, which was, you know, you're getting sued. I know you don't want to talk, but if you don't talk to me, the only thing coming out is this document and the person who's suing you. And that was good motivation. And more often than not, then people would often talk to me. And so then, and treat them fairly and quote them as much as you quote the opposing side and do that whole thing. With this though, I think people can kind of defer and defer and defer up and up and up and up the chain until you just get like a scripted response. So a lot of it's trying to find people affected, trying to find people who go on the record. Sometimes using folks who, you trust and verify who they are. You get their information. Like literally, we see DD2. We will set, make people send us DD214s. We will make people send us, you know, proof that they are, you know, ranked uniform members of the service, those kinds of things. If they're making claims, they must have documents. I'm not, and no one on my staff, as far as I know, is going to report anything without something documented, like in writing. It's not just an accusation, for instance, if it's something more controversial. And sometimes that shuts folks down. They just want to be, they think everything's Watergate in their deep throat. And trust me, your little thing at some little base, sorry guys, like you're not bringing out a president. Let's just get real. Like this isn't Hollywood.
So I want to give you a second to cover like top. I don't think they're your beat, but they're like topics you've covered before that you've like expressed some interest in. So like the ones you've mentioned to me before are marksmanship and fitness as like favorite topics of yours. And I also want to throw in a third one that we know you've covered before, like the VA stuff, veterans issues stuff. Yeah. And I'm just kind of curious, like elevator pitch style, like what do you look for in those topics? What attracted you to those topics, what you've covered, that kind of stuff.
Well, so it's kind of a strange. So I was hired, just a kind of quick background. So Military Times is Army Times, Air Force Times, Marine Corps Times, Navy Times. We also partner with, we're not partner, we're actually same exact company.
Space everything. Force and Times coming out soon.
No, we're thinking about it. So don't steal the thunder.
The comet, the meteor. I mean, there's so many options here.
Well, we also have a cyber magazine, C4IS, which has been around for like 5 years now. And we have, of course, we're Defense News, which is like the business to government kind of contracting dollars and cents of it, which is, again, we share content back and forth. I write for them sometimes. So I only laid that out to kind of give you the breadth of kind of what we have. And I'm a weird kind of character because when I was hired here, the company used to be owned by Gannett, the media company, and it was sold, I want to say it was 2016 or 17. I came here in 17 to a private equity investor. The company is Mega International. The subsidiary is Sightline Media Group. That's kind of what we're owned by. Sorry for all the boring details. The reason I say is because I was hired in as kind of a hybrid senior reporter and soon kind of went into more of an editing / reporting role where I write across all the brands. Now, because we're a very small staff and in a lot of publications and a lot to cover, my expertise is mostly with Army, Marine Corps, ground side items. So if there's a pie chart of my coverage, I'd say like 80% of it is Army and Marine Corps. And then it's really just a matter of we have such a small staff across all these brands that I just pick up topics I like and nobody else is reporting on, or I find something interesting and novel and want to go after it. And because I've been here for a long time and been doing it, I have the permission to do that. As far as the ones you mentioned, I mean, I was Marine, I was in recon. I like shooting. I like fitness. I think it's interesting. I wish I had half the crap they have now, you know, when I was in a long time ago. So it's always kind of interesting and exciting to me. Like I go to PO Soldier all the time, see new equipment, you know, try to do stuff with all the small arm stuff. Fitness, I have like just a lot of sports background and then my military time. I'm by no means any kind of like, I have no accreditation, no training like you guys do. Just, you know, I was thinking how to characterize my fitness journey. And it would be a whole lot of indoctrination of Arnold and pumping iron.
Good place to start.
Flex muscle and fitness throughout the 90s.
Brilliant.
And if you looked at my workouts, like outside of my sports life, it was probably a lot of disorganized junk volume.
It's a perfect Marine though. I mean, like that's exactly what you need.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. So that's like the fitness part of it. So the fitness part of it, I just personally, I just throw little anecdote stories in here. I'll steal stories from other people here on these anecdotes for conversational purposes. I'm gonna blank on the name. Oh, so I believe, and then someone's going to correct me out there. I believe that this story is from Jimmy Breslin, who was a famous New York reporter back in like the 40s, 50s, 60s. He's a well-known name within like the annals of journalism. When JFK was assassinated and then they had the funeral, everybody, like every reporter worth his or her salt was where? They were covering the funeral. They were at that parade where that footage you see, you know, JFK Jr. saluting the casket and all that, poignant, tragic, needs covering. There were probably 50 reporters covering that. What Jimmy Breslin did was go to Arlington National Cemetery and he spent the day with a guy digging JFK's grave. And he wrote a profile of that man, a common man who saw the highest honor of his working life was to dig the grave of a fallen president. And I heard that story in undergrad, and I was like, well, that's like, I want to go where other people are not. So that sounds all romantic and stuff. So I'm obviously like a lot of stuff that I do, I still have to go to press conferences and do other things, but whenever possible, I don't want to be around other reporters. I don't want to be just getting the same quote that everybody else is getting. I don't want to be covering. Honestly, I kind of like, I'm almost allergic to the big story, and tell my boss that I'll probably get fired. But like the big story to me is boring. Like everybody's covering it. Everyone's saying the same thing. Like I'll go cover the thing that somebody else doesn't want to cover. So unfortunately, when I got here 6 years ago, as great as the staff is, and there were a handful of veterans on staff, other than one editor whose husband was had been in the Army, no one else on staff shot firearms. And so I'm like, okay, well, I know about firearms. I'll write about firearms. and hardly anybody was like big into fitness. Later on, we got some folks that were a little more like that. So I was like, oh, well, nobody's really covering fitness. You know, I kind of argued after a couple of years with some of the folks, especially the non-veterans. They like to write about the big contracts and like the next stealth bomber or the next, you know, new ship being built. And I'm like, that's all well and good. We got to cover it. It's like, our taxes go to that. It's important for the platforms, blah, 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 blah. But trust me, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, they care about their next fitness test, mm-hmm. their uniforms, their food, and if they're getting promoted or a pay raise. If you cover those four things, you've pretty much covered everything that soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen kind of care about. So I just try to cover that stuff. So.
Well, what I know you wanted to commentate on the VA. So go for it.
So I just wanted to throw in another voice. I just wanted to say this.
Please.
First of all, I've listened to every one of your podcasts, like literally every single one. And there's a couple times VA disability stuff has come up on the podcast, and all well and good, all true, all worth considering, all worth a serious look at the system, not pushing back any whatsoever was what was said. I just wanted to add from personal experience that I still to this day know multiple, personally know, and have also reported on people, and I can say without too much detail, my own personal life, people who 15, 20 years later still have not gone to VA for things they should go to for. And I know friends who are drinking themselves to sleep, you know, 20 years after combat, who still aren't getting the help they need.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just, there's a personal tone to it. I've seen it like, and I know maybe they're the minority, maybe that's the margins, and I know anecdotal is not scientific. I'm a reporter. I'm fully aware of that, but I just didn't want that to be lost in the conversation that there are still people out there who are not getting the help they need, who are getting denied help that they did request, and having to appeal in a very complex system with very little assistance. And I know it's probably not the majority anymore. And maybe a lot of that's my generation from 20 years ago who faced a different system going into it after they got out. But there are people out there that are not getting help they need to get. And it's just, I think the system is definitely, it may overcorrect in some areas. I think that definitely needs to be explored. And there's a pendulum swing to things. Obviously, if you were going in the VA in 2003, 4, 5, where some of my friends were versus now, it was an entirely different experience. And I know, again, personally know maybe a dozen or so people who battled that for years and never got through and just gave up, mm-hmm. and are not getting the help they need. So
I think that's a huge part of the story that deserves to be talked about. And I'm going to try not to go too far down this rabbit hole, but you brought up some really good points there. And I think one that I think about a lot is that guys who served when you served paved the way with scar tissue and unfortunate experiences and things like that, so that people who serve now have like a very, very different experience of what the VA is.
Glad, yeah, they should. Yeah, I hope. Yeah.
And I think that's really important. But I also think there's another, like there's two other phenomena that you got me thinking about. And one is that sometimes it's the most deserving people who are getting the least support because they're the least likely to ask for help and things like that. And then the people who are predisposed to like soak up all the support they can possibly get may not be the ones who need it the most, yada, yada. And the last one, and this goes way beyond the VA, this goes to like every federal system ever, is that the people who need it the least have the easiest time navigating it. And I'm going to hate on my own people for a second, but officer skills, like the bullshit bureaucratic skills that serve you well on like battalion and brigade and division staffs and things like that, are the exact same skills that get you through these ridiculous federal bureaucracies. And whether it's VA disability stuff, whether it's GI Bill stuff, whether it's voc rehab stuff,
Valor Awards.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of these things, it's like easiest to access for the people who probably need it the least because they're in the best position to start with and things like that. I just get frustrated by that all the time.
No, I think it's a fair characterization. And I just want to reemphasize, I wasn't like, I think a lot of the stuff you guys have brought up about like people getting like having a disability mindset and like gaming the system, absolutely that exists and it definitely needs to be looked at. And I mean, I'm sure there is reporting on it. There should be more of it. And I mean, we should do more reporting on it for sure. I just didn't want that to be like, I just think there's always another part of it I miss, you know?
So. Absolutely. And okay. So speaking of that, this is a nice transition to a question I wanted to ask. And before recording, I think we were talking about Nick Barringer. Shout out Nick. Service members publishing op-eds. What is kind of the, and I don't even know how to phrase this question, just sort of the bigger media perspective on that, your thoughts and opinions on that, because I mean, Alex and I have gotten some sent to us as kind of like, hey, give this a quick look before I push it out from different folks. And I think it's really valid to have those voices in the room, but then you do butt up against sort of the controversy of like, in Nick's case, like how dare you speak out against XYZ?
Yeah, it's hard. So it's strange because, you know, I mean, I was at a low level, you know, in the Marines when I was in, I reached sergeant and then I got out. So I never had the desire or interest to, you know, write a commentary. I wasn't ever at high enough levels to really maybe know some of the more complex issues going on or things to kind of how to report certain things if they happen or to share stuff out with just the general public. So from that perspective, I didn't really have much experience. But as a journalist, I can just say, and I go back to my roots, you know, the local news, local papers, newspaper reporting, you know, the commentary page, editorial pages, I think are just, you know, because we have the slow death of newspapers and people are, I get that, like, but like, in theory, that should be the place for that exact kind of debate. And, and I don't know, like, I think perhaps with a previous generation 20 odd years ago, there might've been an argument for like, you know, stay in line, the rank order and file, you know, that kind of stuff. But I don't know, nowadays when people can anonymously post whatever they want, I'd kind of like to see somebody with their name on something that's been vetted and edited and thought through. Like if you truly want, as a commander, like if you're a brigade commander and above and you really want to, you're kind of getting, you know, you're probably getting a little disconnected from, you know, what's going on in the lower ranks and with your subordinates and with the masses of the soldiers. I mean, I would hope you would want to hear some honest feedback and not just what you want to hear. And they say that. They say that's what they want. Like just as a unified voice, they say that. So I think commentaries, I mean, I frankly don't even think that the command should be reviewing or censoring things as long as there's not any classified material. I mean, if it's like open criticism and they have valid, and that's the thing is too, is I guess, I'm sorry, I'm jumping a bit, but with your question without the commentary, so you got to think about it like an A and B comparison, right? Would you rather have a young, eager captain who, you know, has been in long enough to see a few things and has some ideas about how things could change, just getting feedback from troops at the kind of the ground level? Would you rather have that young captain writing a well thought out 750 word to 1,000 word commentary piece on an issue that's going to go in Army Times, where literally like congressional liaisons are reading that? Like that's one of our, we get quoted a lot in Ask and Sask meetings, and that's going to be something that actually is sees the light of day of people who actually have power to make change, and it's edited and vetted by a news organization that, you know, looks at source material and verifies the person's, you know, identity and has a dialogue with them before publishing? Or do you want them to get so frustrated they can't speak out that they just, you know, blindly and honestly post on Reddit and Facebook and just trash the Army constantly because they're frustrated? Make it easier. I mean, my goodness, like there should be some, I don't know, I definitely have a dog in the fight, and I'm definitely biased on that journalistic aspect, but yeah.
This has me thinking a lot because I've been in that position before. So I don't think I've done anything in military times, but I've done one on like a famous blog. I've done an op-ed in military.com. So like I've done this before. I've also been in a position where I wrote an op-ed that I felt pretty strongly about that I was convinced by my leadership not to publish. That we'll see if that comes out later. But
now I'm curious.
It'll come out later.
I'll talk about the context where it came out though, because I think it's extremely relevant and it ties back to some of the things we've talked about before, is that recently it's settled down a little bit. The force has kind of accepted what the ACFT is, and we're like, it's getting implemented and things like that. But for a long time there, the ACFT was the hot topic. Like every few months, something would change, or every few months, a new article would come out, or something was going on ACFT related all the time for several years there. And like, I was in the thick of it with my work and I was thinking about it a lot. And what happened was, anytime senior leaders had a decision to make, the Army would surrender the communication space. Like they would not engage with the media at all if any decision was about to be made. And that left all, like, we basically surrendered that entire space to the people who wanted to hate on the ACFT, who wanted to talk about how bad it was and how it was like horrible to this subgroup or whatever it was. And I think that has serious ramifications in the version of the ACFT that we got today, because the people who are most likely to speak out are the people who are getting harmed by something. They're like more motivated to speak out when you're harmed than when you're helped. That's normal. And because we were not willing to like be in the space fighting for what seemed like it was important. And like most of the people who like wanted to say stuff that were supportive had like work stuff to balance and didn't want to get into the political space of all this. I worry that the fight happened and the people who were on the side of higher fitness standards just had to be silent for a variety of like political and bureaucratic reasons. So it was hard to watch.
No, I think the structure of what you're saying could be like the template of that could be put on almost any topic within the military. Like, I mean, I think that's a great example because it's relevant obviously to this podcast and our conversation and people know a lot about it. But I'm just saying like, exactly. Yes. The term I always get when I start asking like actual detailed questions about things, instead of just taking a quote that somebody spit out in a press release, is, well, that's pre-decisional. It's like, okay, well, I'm still going to write about it. Like, I don't care if you guys take 2 years to decide about it. I'm going to write about it tomorrow. So you can either have a voice in it or not. Going back to my example about a lawsuit, right? You're getting sued. Do you want to talk about it or have the person suing you be the only one talking? Because I'm still quoting them. I gave you the opportunity, called you 3 times, left you an email, gave you 24 hours, 40 hours, whatever it was. You got to call me back. Same thing with the military. I mean, and by the way, the Army's not special. All the branches do the same thing. I report on five now, of all the branches, and they all do the exact same thing. It's the same script, the same playbook. And again, I'm not blaming the PAOs. I know it's structural, it's bureaucratic, it's like many levels of approval. And their idea for them is messaging, is communication strategy. Like, I mean, some of the branches have even changed public affairs officer titles to Comstrat, communication strategy. And that to me is a sign that you're not open to the public. You're strategizing your communication for the best effect for you, but not for the people who are actually like paying the bill and sending people to serve in your ranks. So that's my little soapbox, but anyways.
We'll get back on track in a second, but this brought up a question I have to ask. Do you know David Brown, or do you know why clearancejobs.com was on the warpath against the ACFT?
No, I don't. I'm totally out of the loop.
This goes like all the way back to 2019, but like one particular dude was
clearancejobs.com.
Yeah, clearancejobs.com, not like a news outlet, just like a place that helps people apply.
Sounds like some place that sells like OxyClean.
No, clearances in the federal security.
Yeah, I know,
sense,
but just but like, you know.
But like, I was shocked because this is like during the period where I would have loved to be speaking publicly and was not allowed to, and this guy wrote some like extremely, extremely aggressive editorial kind of pieces. When I Googled clearance jobs ACFT, the first one that came up was Army Combat Fitness Test Fiasco. This is what we allowed to come out instead of having like better structured, better referenced conversations. I don't know. We'll get back on the track of the episode, but
it goes to another level. I would just say, you know, I've experienced many times where, say, a particular, you know, great example. I mean, a tragic example, but a great example. Like Fort Hood, well, formerly Fort Hood. Like, you know, so when the Vanessa Gideon stuff happened, tragic case scenario, I'm sure nobody really wants to talk about that, but they have to. And that's an example where one bad thing happens there, a terrible, terrible thing that definitely needs to be addressed. But every single other piece of news out of Fort Hood gets shut down. Mm-hmm. They could have like the highest performing ACFT team at all in this particular unit, but they're just not going to talk to the press because somebody might ask about Vanessa Gideon. And for like a lockdown for like weeks or months. And this happens all the time. And I'm just like, I don't understand like what the POs are being told, how they're being trained. Like, and I know many, many times, 99% of the time is not even their choice. Like command's telling them, oh, great. Thank you for the great advice on my media strategy. I know you have all the training, but blow off. I'm not going to talk to them. Like that's just, it happens all the time.
We should start a PAO support group off the back of this episode.
They need it, man. I don't know. Like, I'm serious. I give them some heck, but you know, it's a hard job. It's a really hard job.
So we're kind of circling a topic we wanted to chat about a little bit. And it's just kind of like the nature of finding controversial topics. Cause we know that, like you mentioned earlier, people notice the bad stuff, mm-hmm. and you're a business, you have to get clicks and things like that.
That's why we bash powerlifting on Instagram to get clicks.
Hey, it works. In your experience, what topics provoke the strongest reactions from your audience, and specifically the strongest reaction from soldiers?
Oh, anything with body comp.
I've noticed that.
Anything with uniforms.
Like the changing of uniforms?
Yeah.
Like
any kind of change to uniforms. People have a lot of opinions and most of them are negative. And sadly, it's just part of the game. Anytime female service members, like we report on female service members, like doing something for the first time or doing like formal, even now, like however many years it's been since an integration of combat roles and all that stuff. Even now, it's still, people have all kinds of stuff to say about, you know, the first female ranger, whatever, the first, you know, female, whatever, doesn't matter, sapper, doesn't matter.
I was astonished recently, a friend of mine won an award for like company level leader performance stuff. And I forget, I think it was posted on ForceComm's page or something like that, like a major Army organization posted on their Facebook page. And people using like their Facebook pages where their identities are there, like you can see their name, were saying some of the most outrageous, because this was a woman who was an infantry officer. And people were saying outrageous things attached to their actual names. And I guarantee, like, I didn't go through it, but like you could pull up Global next to it and just start seeing who has accounts in Global. And like, man, I don't know how people feel comfortable saying that stuff.
Is it safe to say all three of the topics you just mentioned have to do with change? It sounds like anything related to change, people just like, and I don't know if that, I mean, we're obviously in a bit of an echo chamber with the military, but it's like, maybe because it's an organization that is so steeped in like history and tradition. Because we joked about this with Dr. East talking about the history of physical culture. And it's like when we shifted from, I don't remember, 90 mile cavalry rides to whatever the next PT test was in the 1900s, were people up in arms because, oh shit, we're doing a new thing. It's like every time something changes, people have a thought and opinion on it.
I think that's a great observation. Yeah, I wish I would have thought of it. That's the theme for sure. It's like when there's change, especially in that much more kind of conservatively, not politically, but just like culturally conservative mindset of the military. Like, yeah, I think anytime there's change, and that acts like the tails all this time, right? Like I'm sure the guys in, you know, doing the strongman style, you know, lifting in the early 1900s were like, what's this jogging thing? You know,
I don't know. I get frustrated by it a lot because, like, by far the content that we produce that gets the most engagement is like around similar thing. Like, it's always around issues that impact whether the soldier gets to stay in uniform or like pass fail type of things. Like I will never ever generate as much interest in something that is about teaching soldiers how to train more effectively than I will about a policy change. And it's frustrating because I put tons of effort into some of that stuff. And like the policy change posts on the Instagram or whatever, they take no time. I'm just like, I'm finding the key sentences, putting it on a generic background. I even did one recently. I did a whole thing on like the ForceComm Day in the Life report that we've talked about before. And the post I had done before it was about a Navy policy change, and I forgot to change the background. So it's a post all about Army stuff, and the background is a bunch of destroyers from the Navy. And like nobody even noticed. Like they were all just riled up about the policy change. Like two people noticed that my background was boats and it was a post about Army stuff. Like they're just all riled up about policy change. That's it.
I believe it. No, I believe it. I believe it. Yeah, it's.
But do you think that that's because, I don't know where I'm going with this. Maybe there's a question here somewhere, but like we talk, you know, people get so worked up about change. People get so upset. Is that it's because it's the loudest voices in the room and the people that agree, the non-dissenters or whatever, just like don't feel the need to speak up? Because we notice this with a lot of our stuff. Like we'll put something out, people will get inflamed about it, but then you'll also have this sort of silent majority that'll reach out privately, be like, hey, I really liked it. I really love what you guys, you know, blah, 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 blah. So it's still engaging. It's just not engaging at the same sort of inflammatory level, if that makes sense.
I would definitely agree. I would say, actually, sorry, just throwing like references out there, but there's an amazing essay I read, I think it was like 10 years ago. I want to say it was in GQ. It was called The Brain Dead Megaphone.
Who?
And it's basically, you probably Google that and probably find it. But
let's put that in the show notes.
It's basically like that, roughly that theory. Now it was applying it to like the emerging voices on like YouTube and emerging, this is 10 years ago, like on different social media channels. Basically, yeah, the loudest voice in the room gets it, but that might be a fraction of the actual, you know, opinion of the whole populace, but it's the loudest voice in the room. And just the louder you can shout, no matter, even if you don't have like good information, you're still going to get the most attention. So yeah, I think that's accurate. Yeah.
Well, I think we see that in the fitness space, especially people trying to espouse, you know, you can never just stay. I think, Alec, maybe you posted this today, just the basics. People ignore the basics because they think that because they're called the basics, they need to do something different, fancier, you know, whatever. And at the end of the day, it's the tried and true stuff that works and is going to get you to where you want to go.
Yeah, the nutrition space in particular seems rife with that challenge.
Let's go there.
You will find the craziest stuff. The latest one, a headline got like massive coverage of, I forget which oil is like neurotoxic or whatever. And nobody is addressing the fact that it was in a Petri dish study where like the amount they put in there with like a couple neurons in the Petri dish is an amount that's like impossible to achieve in your body. That like everything is toxic if you concentrate it highly enough. It doesn't mean anything about consuming it. But I've seen it in like every major outlet. I've seen it all over social media. It like the term neurotoxic scares people and they want to believe that like the government has had it out for them from the beginning and stuff like that.
Chemtrails.
Well, no, that's a pretty good segue to, you know, the like media coverage of fitness and health and nutrition and supplement, things like that. You know, I mean, I think, now I've not been a dedicated reporter in that arena. I just wanted like one little slice of a big pie that I try to cover here. But having like, as I mentioned earlier, like having quote unquote cut my teeth on like Muscle and Fitness and Flex magazine as a teenager in like the early 90s to now, and then having some journalism training and seeing it, I kind of understand some of the behind the curtain aspects of how that gets reported and how that gets out there. And I look at my stuff. I'm sure there's stuff out there that I've done that I would be super proud of now that I've had a little more education on it. But a lot of it is, I'm going to keep making more references. There's another really great essay that I also recommend people read by a guy named Chuck Klosterman.
Show notes.
I know I've read a ton of stuff, but I have a hard time pronouncing his name. And essentially he lays out, because he started out as a local reporter too, and he worked at like a weekly newspaper, and was it Akron, Ohio? It was Akron Beacon Journal. Sorry for the ephemera there, but anyway, so he's basically talking, this is years later, about kind of here's how journalism works at a local level. And it was essentially, he gets an assignment, he's got to like interview, you know, some expert about XYZ topic. He literally got the assignment like 11 o'clock that morning, story has to be in by 5, you know, he knows nothing about it. So this is pre-internet, he's reading everything he can in the paper clip files, he's ringing up people in the phone directory, and he lays out the essence of it is, I rang up 5 people trying to get them to call me back by 5. The guy who calls me back is the expert I'm using. So sometimes I bring that example up to say that sadly in understaffed, which is most news organizations now, severely, drastically understaffed, underpaid and overworked, definitely writing more than they should with not enough time to really edit, and very few editors to even edit that copy to begin with, now versus say 10, 15, 20 years ago, you are not going to get the most robust, like vetted and time spent. And like, it's basically, did you spell it right? Do you get both sides of the argument? Does this person have actual credentials, or are they just, you know, some fly by night person on social media? If those 3 things match, we got a story, let's publish. We got to move on to the next thing. You know, bylines are waiting, you know, kind of thing. So I'm not defending it. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. I'm not proud of it. I've seen it devolve in such a way over the last 20 years of my career that I started a local newspaper with about 30,000 circulation, which is quite small. And I had 3 editors minimum, 3 editors, sometimes 4 or more, and a copy desk. Read the headline, read the photo caption, read the story top to bottom, edit, revise it, push it back for changes, send it back, or spike it or kill it if it was wrong, before it ever saw the light of day. And we are probably one of the more responsible of some of the news organizations in our space. I'm not talking about the biggies like New York Times and Washington Post, but in our space. And oftentimes one editor reads it and it goes online. And that's just the nature of, we've got, everybody's writing 5 things every day, and there's, you know, 6 people writing and one editor read it, and they've got 8 hours in a day, and that's how they do it. So that's, again, not a defense, but like, that's where some of that stuff comes from.
Well, how do you, I mean, there's probably an obvious discussion around, you know, the speed with which social media operates versus traditional journalism. So how do you balance, I guess, what gets clicks with the stories that actually matter, that I would imagine take more time, more thought, et cetera, but you have to turn things around so quickly.
So you kind of break it apart. So for instance, like back to the example from the H2F conference, actually a pretty relevant example. So I'm there. I mean, I've got information on the screen. It's sourced, you know, through the Army. I can verify that within a few seconds or minutes online. I've got an official in their official capacity, by rank, in uniform, saying something on stage publicly to a group. Like, I can quote that, you know, so I have that information. So I write with what I have.
Mm-hmm.
What that particular colonel or that speaker, whoever it was, said might generate five other questions I'd love to explore in a longer piece, but I got to write something today. So I stick with what he or she said. I find if there's any kind of countervailing opinion quickly. I put it together. I make sure it's all good to go, read through it, send it off to an editor to get revisions and post and put out online. And then what I do is I hold back, and everyone's a little different. Not everybody's the same way. I'm just talking about myself. I hold back a couple ideas that this is going to require a couple more questions. I'm going to need more data points on this. I'll give you an example. I was part of we have what's called an embargoed roundtables, meaning they will give you the information, they will do the interview, they'll answer your questions, but you're not allowed to publish it until a certain date because they're like releasing a report or something. So for instance, I was in a group, like there's like 20 reporters on this call. It was a Marine issue, and they were laying out all this stuff, these different things they were going to do. And I specifically focused on a particular piece of that. I'm being cagey because the story hasn't come out yet. So I focused on a particular piece of that. And I had a lot of questions. And luckily, the other reporters had enough material to put out some things from that call within the next day or two once the embargo lifted. So we weren't like on the hook to have what I wanted to write about out that next day. So I had like literally a list of like 9 questions that I had to get through 3 different offices in the Marine Corps over the course of like 3 weeks to get the actual answers. And now I'll write that piece 3 weeks later. I'll just kind of write it in a way, hopefully, that pushes it forward rather than just focus on something that happened 3 or 4 weeks ago. That's just the nature of kind of how you craft the writing. So.
Well, I guess the internet obviously isn't new anymore, but I would imagine as compared to sort of traditional journalism with, you know, newspaper, hard copy, whatever, now you have this element of data and feedback that allows you to publish something and then see how the audience reacts. And then do you end up just sort of chasing, I don't want to say rabbit holes, but like chasing different leads based on what people respond to? Does that generate sort of ideas for a follow-on story, or do you try to stay ahead of it, if that makes sense?
Fortunately, fortunately, I've not had, at this publication, the 6 years I've worked here, I've not had that pressure to chase numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, so we have systems like we can, and some reporters do, I'm not criticizing, that's their choice. Some reporters know, they could tell you right now what their numbers are for today or yesterday, or whatever. I came up kind of, I spent a good chunk of time in journalism before that was even available.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of try to learn to trust my gut and trust my editor's opinion and whatever feedback I got from readers. And I'll just tell another anecdote. I'm a journalist, so I like to tell stories. I was working at a paper in New Jersey, and it was the last, I think, or one of the last family-owned newspapers in New Jersey. It's called The Record. It was the second largest paper in the state. And this is 7, 8, maybe 9 years ago. And I was reporting there, and we competed very frequently with the Star Ledger, which was the largest paper in the state and had won a Pulitzer a few years before and was quite good. And they were out of Newark, and they were a big competitor. They covered the whole state. So we had to compete with them quite a bit. You get friendly with your competitors. Like, you all kind of hang out eventually. You're always at the same events. You know the other reporters pretty well. Well, I can't remember what company, but some company came in and bought out the Star Ledger. Again, literally, this paper had won a Pulitzer like just a few years before. Highly competitive, very well-versed, decades-long reporters and editors who knew New Jersey like the back of their hand. Of course, the company comes in, lays off like half the people, the other half are told, and I'm going to get some of this wrong. I'm sure somebody out there is going to tell me I got some detail wrong, but generally speaking, they kind of got rid of all the beats, so nobody had a dedicated beat, and basically they were all told, here's your base salary. Mm. If you want to make more, you got to get these clicks. So they kind of cut all their salaries down and said, if you want to get back to where you were or a little bit better, you got to generate a certain number of clicks every month. And oh, by the way, next month has to be better than this month. So do the math. I don't know how long that's going to last, right? So it was like a natural experiment. It was like a wonderful natural experiment. We looked at it from the outside. I didn't have to participate, thank God. I just had to watch. And I watched as junior reporters and senior reporters literally quit covering city council meetings, quit covering elections, and basically just, and I mean this literally, not figuratively, just went to the next car crash to get photos and report on the next fatal car crash on the highway.
Mm.
So I know that's an extreme example, and there's way, way more nuanced and technical ways to do it. And I'm not trying to be a curmudgeon or a Luddite, but when I saw that happen, I was like, I'm not looking at numbers. And if that costs me my job, it costs me my job.
So I was wondering about, I think the answer you just gave is probably the right way to go about this, but, and I'm asking this from personal experience, because I've been there. Have you had the experience of like pouring yourself into a project you think is really important and putting a ton of effort into it and developing a really good article and getting like no reaction, and then putting like zero effort into a really fast piece and it blowing up?
Or a video of you working out in tights. I mean, just, you know, just anecdotally, Alex has never done that.
So, yes. And that's probably most of my existence for the last two decades.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just, I have literally like, I have spent, and I'm not exaggerating, 30 plus hours, 40 plus hours over the course of multiple weeks, like digging through court records and files by hand with paper to create my own databases to prove a trend I saw in a court thing that broke news and maybe even won like a local or regional award later, and literally like, no shit, like wrote about like a fatal car crash on the highway or, oh, the best, like I basically rewrote like portions of a press release with added quote or two, which is what we call aggregations, hardly any what we even call reporting, just because we had to get the news out and it was a short-term notice. When they announced the new Sergeant Major of the Army a while back, Sergeant Major Weimer, I'm probably going to mispronounce that. That one thing that took me like 15 minutes to write up from a press release, two quotes and a couple Google searches, got more clicks than anything I did the entire month. It was like four paragraphs. It was just the name of the new Sergeant Major. Okay. That if I had a click count, that took care of it for the next 2 weeks. But then the thing I poured my heart into and like dug around and knocked on doors for, and you know, but that's why, again, I don't care about the, I can't care about the clicks, or I go crazy. So
one last question, because we're bumping up against the hour mark here, and sure. And this is one that I guarantee will frustrate some people that I work with. I don't know if I shared this anecdote on the podcast before, but I do know some of the lawyers in my command listen to this, and it's because they've had to listen to it to investigate me before to see if I was going to get in trouble for this. So that's awesome.
Shout out lawyers.
And this one in particular will trigger them for sure. As an amateur investigative journalist myself, I've played around with Freedom of Information Act requests on a couple of occasions, and I would love to get your feedback on it. My overall thoughts are, I'm surprised I haven't been fired. You would think that just like submitting one of those would get like a target on your back, but so far I've been okay. But I'd love to hear your thoughts from outside of the government.
What you mean, like about the process or about
the process, what you've been able to get, how the reaction is? Because I know we've talked about this offline a little bit. I got surprisingly fast responses the couple times I've done it. It sounds like in your experience, it takes a lot longer. I'm just wondering what it's like trying to access some of that stuff from the outside, even though the whole purpose of it is so that like the citizens who pay the taxes that make this whole government run are supposed to have access to understand how it works. You would think people would be more supportive of that idea, but not so much, at least in my experience.
People, I think it's funny because I think people, what I'm about to say, people like think like this was like planned, but it was absolutely not, because I have a huge soapbox about FOIA, and I've had one for years.
Oh, please.
I was very fortunate. I went to a great, just by accident, went to a great undergrad journalism school at Georgia. And I had some great professors, like my first semester, second semester in undergrad, like teach us about state open records laws and FOIA. And I got involved with IRE, Investigative Reporters and Editors. It's a nonprofit organization for investigative reporters and editors. And like, that's their bread and butter. It's like, literally, I remember columns that they would have in their magazine about like highlighting like FOIA rock stars, like guys who would, and gals, like no crap, like they would file a FOIA a day every day, like every day on the job, they'd file at least one.
But Alex aspires to.
Yeah, no, we have, I would say our FOIA rock star by hands down is Jeff Zizulowitz. He's our senior Navy Times reporter. And that guy, I mean, he could give you a clinic on how to file FOIAs.
As a brief aside, I do have a friend who will go unnamed here as well to protect his own career and identity and stuff, who, the problem is like you attach your name when you FOIA stuff, because they have to be able to contact you back. And like, there's only so many times you can FOIA the same command before like the office knows your name, and it's a problem. So,
oh, I'm sure. No, yeah. No, it's interesting. So as far as the FOIA as a concept, like as a tool, is amazing for journalists, but it's for citizens. Like it's literally so that like little, John Smith, Jane Smith property owner in Nebraska can know if the water they're drinking is healthy, and they can see the reports, so they can get the EPA report. Like that's what it's for. I mean, journalists use it because that's our bread and butter. As far as access and response, like that's part of the question you ask. It really depends. If you're looking for, and this is, I think, where you might have benefited quite a bit in your FOIAs, if you know the regulation and you know the report, or you know the report authors, and you know where it's housed, it can be very quick and easy, because that's very specific. If it's not classified, it only requires minimal redaction. Usually that can come back in a few weeks or months, not a big deal. But as an example, reporters, we want to know a lot more, right? So like, for example, a lot of times, we'll have like fatal aircraft crashes. We want to get the maintenance records. We want to get this. So all that freezes and holds up because it's under investigation. So they can hide it behind FOIA. They hide FOIA behind that because they don't have to release records until if they're under investigation. They have records, back to that term, pre-decisional. They can actually, like, the deliberative process. So for instance, I and one of my colleagues who's not with us anymore, he took another job 2 years ago. So and that's relevant. So here we go. So 3 or 4 years ago, I want to say it was at least 3 years ago. My colleague Phil Athey, who was the senior Marine Corps Times reporter at the time, and I were like digging into the Marine Corps force design process. So about 4 or 5 years ago, 4 years ago, the commandant laid out this plan, this vision to kind of radically transform the Marine Corps. They got rid of tanks. They changed mm-hmm. the size of the squad. They changing the size of the infantry battalion. Things that haven't been done in like 80 years. It was just massive, hugely controversial. I mean, a lot of voices on both sides of the argument, and we've covered that to no end, right? So about a year or two in, we're like, hey, we want to know, like, how did they come up with these decisions? Who had the input? Who did the studies? Like, what's the empirical data behind what you're putting out in the press and what you're putting out in your official report, And so we started requesting emails. We started requesting, some of the source material and things like that was kind of derived to make these reports. And Phil Athey left a Marine Corps Times 2 years ago. He transferred all of his FOIA stuff because he went off to cover non-military stuff to me. I am still receiving denials for his FOIA request 3 years later. I did get a few back, and their emails, some of those innocuous, inane emails, like they're just almost conversational meeting agenda crap. Is there like a meeting for the forces? Because you have to kind of blanket it's not very specific. You have to blanket any and all emails with subject headings or content regarding force design 2030 sent to or from Commandant General David Berger from these dates to these dates. And so it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot to pull out, right? And then through their process, they have to redact them all. And oh, by the way, yeah, they're on a clock, but they can push that and extend that with certain exemptions. And you're not coming in like top of the line. I mean, you're like number 5, 6, 10, 20 on their list, and they'll get to you when they get to you. So it can be a mixed bag. It just depends on how you're requesting, what you're requesting, who you're requesting it from, and how cooperative they want to be. So I did state records requests for all my local reporting for years. And I had that practice. I kind of put into practice what I'd read when I was a young undergrad. And I would do like a state request a day. Every single day I would put in a state records request, and those would come back within a few weeks or months. So I would have like a rolling like bin of things coming in that I could kind of report off of or do follow-up reporting on. So,
well, but before we hit record on this episode, we were wondering whether we were going to dive into AFI's stuff, and we have filled up our hour with good conversation without going down that rabbit hole. But I will say, in light of the comments you have just made, I want to do a quick shout out to Teresa at AFI's, who's the one who has to deal with all of my FOIA requests. Because although I may disagree with some things and maybe going after some stuff, Teresa has been lovely. She's fantastic. She's a grandmother down in Texas. She's extremely nice, and she responds promptly to all of my questions.
Have you become friends with the FOIA lady at AFI's?
She called me a couple times to sort stuff out.
How did the fact that she's a grandmother come up?
I do know she was like, she had to go to her grandkids' swim meet or something. Come on.
Would you can leave this in or take it out. It's up to you, but would you like a couple like FOIA tips that some people don't really know?
This would be fantastic.
Okay.
Yes.
So, and this is maybe more of a reporter thing. I don't know if it'd be helpful for you, but maybe, I don't know. So one thing, and they may call it something different, but one thing every governmental agency has to keep is a records retention schedule. And what that is by law, they have to retain records in a certain form and format and store them in a certain way up to certain dates. And then they can discard them or dispose of them. And there's instructions for that too. If they have to send them to the National Archives or if they can like literally just destroy them. So if you ever just want to know like what all they keep and yet you may not have heard of, you can get the records retention schedule. You can FOIA just the schedule. It'll just give you the titles and like the basic disposition. So you can get kind of an index of all the records they have to report. And there will be many, many records they report that are not on that list, but that's a huge like umbrella kind of request.
That's a super useful insight because I know having had conversations about this before, some people think that FOIA is just a way to ask questions. And it's not. You have to know that the thing you're asking for exists. You can't just like say, I want to know the answer to a thing and make them create it for you. It only applies.
ChatGPT.
Yeah, it only applies if the document is there. So knowing what the like organization of documents is would be huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And most of the time, if you're running into problems, because like I say, nine times out of 10 in my experience, you know, local, state, federal, every level I've worked at, the PAO or PR person, no matter how good they are and how much they do want to help you, and that's kind of 50-50. They often know nothing about the records. And so every agency, this is another like a reporting thing, every agency has a records custodian. Now, sometimes that person doesn't know they are the records custodian, like in a military unit, like every S1 has to have a records custodian. Like that's like by regulation, like they have to, and they may not even know that they're the person that's supposed to do it.
I don't recall ever knowing who the records custodian was.
You're supposed to have records.
I've ever been.
Every single unit, I think it's the battalion, at least the brigade, but maybe battalion level has to have a records custodian. That has to be a billet for someone to fill on the military side. But it's true of every organization, whether it's a sheriff's office or the FBI or whatever. And they can usually translate your requests. So you can kind of ask like, who's your records custodian? If they don't know, find out. And then CC them and they can kind of help translate what they do and don't have, or what they can share. And lastly, little as they say, pro tip, which I hate buzzwords, but one thing that I often do, which is I was taught very early on, and very few people do. I don't know why I'm giving away my secrets here, but it's good for everybody. Is you can request what other people request. I can just right now. I can just file a thing to APs and say, give me all requests made by Alex Moreau from this date to this date to your organization, and they will just have to send me a list of everything you've requested.
Nice.
And lastly, every organization, definitely at the service level, usually at the command level, has to keep a FOIA log that must be made public. So they have to show what has been requested of them. Now they can redact titles if they have like classified information in the titles. They're not supposed to redact the requestor, but they sometimes do. So, and that's another battle you have to go through. Sometimes they'll over-redact things. You have to go back and say, no, you can't redact that. Like, you got to put that in there. Anyway.
I have stumbled into a couple documents a couple times on some commands websites where they are documents that get FOIA'd so often the command was just like, screw it, we're putting it on the website.
So SOCOM does that, Marine Corps does that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad, but like, yeah, the big fatal accident.
Yeah, like massive. Like, yeah.
Because they're just like, well, screw it. It's already out there. We'll just post it online and people can grab it whenever they want.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, in the spirit of pro tips, which I know you hate buzzwords, but before we let you go, in terms of consuming news, and this is a little bit of a like softball question, but you know, it comes up all the time and we talked about social media, but just as a journalist who's been doing this for a long time, advice to your average, you know, military member, human being, whatever, how do you consume the best news without ending up on some, you know, super bipolar atmosphere of essentially information overload?
So I'm going to say something that like I seriously doubt most other journalists would say.
Perfect.
But I would say consume a lot less of it. I would say consume written material as much as possible, in print if possible. I say this not just because of my own biases, because that's how I enjoy to do it, which is true. Also because, and I wish I had this, I should have looked this up before this podcast, but I want to say it was a number of years ago, but I read so it's a Columbia Journalism Review and an AJ and the AJR, which is American Journalism Review. There are two like kind of industry magazines about journalism. And one of the studies I read years ago that was really encouraging to me was that they did a poll of basically how accurate or well-informed news consumers were on a variety of different like platforms. And this is actually pre-social media, right? So granted, most of your news on social media is coming from news organizations. It just comes up in your social media feed, right? The least informed, I mean, you guys want to guess, or you want me to just like list down
it got to be cable news stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cable news, TV news, cable
Ron
news.
Ron Burgundy?
Least informed, most inaccurate, most like mistakes in understanding things. The best informed were weekly news magazine readers. So people who like basically sit down, read a feature, dedicate some time to a topic, understand it, and read the material. That's the thing too. Is there something different about reading it versus hearing it? I love podcasts. I have no shit, have like 40 podcasts on constant rotation. I also have 20 plus, you know, print magazines and journals that come to my house every month.
Best print magazine, go.
Ooh, for what though?
I don't know. Best, like most accurate, I don't know. Best one. What's the best one?
Oh,
wow. Your house is burning down and for some weird reason, you can only take one print magazine with you. Which one? Because I'm going to go subscribe to it after this.
It's so elitist.
Your house is burning.
He's going to say The Economist.
It's so elitist, but it's the best written stuff, pretty much.
The New Yorker.
The best reported and researched and fact-checked would be the New Yorker magazine.
Yes!
Yeah. They have a legendary fact-checking department. Like, I mean, people to this day still talk about how well. And just to that being said, there are many newspapers, there are a number of magazines who don't even have a fact-checking department anymore. It's just up to the editor to like Google stuff and check their reporter's notes. And the New Yorker, and I've had friends, not me, unfortunately, but I've had friends who've written for the New Yorker, and they're like, it's brutal. Like turning an article into them is like, you question your sanity because they will question everything you put in there. So,
well, this might go without saying, but this episode is not sponsored by the New Yorker yet. Maybe we will be after this. But Todd, thank you for coming on. This has been an insightful, I suppose, soiree into the world of journalism. So thank you.
I do have to ask one question. Am I the first
journalist,
Marine veteran that you've had on the podcast?
You are. You're not the first one we invited.
Oh,
there's another one we got to get back on because
yeah, the Commandant never got back to us. So no, you know,
don't worry, it was not the Commandant. But we have a Navy/Marine topic area we want to cover.
Okay.
I'm actually glad you brought that up on there because this is for the people. We do so many Army episodes because it's the easiest access. So for folks who are in the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Coast Guard, even the Space Force, reach out to us. We'd love to have you on.
Definitely, definitely.
There it is.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.